listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Following its approval by a congressional committee on Monday evening, the Democratic memo produced to rebut the Republican memo issued last Friday regarding the investigations into President Trump over Russiagate is in the president's hands. This was White House spokesperson Sarah Sanders on Tuesday at the Daily Presser at the White House.
The president has seen the memo. He met with the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, within the last hour to discuss some of the differences between the two memos. And we are undergoing the exact same process that we did with the previous memo, in which it will go through a full and thorough legal and national security review. We're in the middle of that process. When that's completed, the president will be given a thorough briefing on the findings of the different organizations and stakeholders that are involved, and we'll make a determination at that time.
Before the review concluded last time, the president had made it clear to lawmakers that he was inclined to release the Republican memo. Has he made any kind of similar comments to you guys about the Democratic memo?
The president made the comment that we're going to go through the same process that we went through the first time, and that'll take several days to complete as it did the first time, and we'll make a determination at that point. John?
Thanks a lot, Sarah. The president on the Republican memo says that it completely vindicates him. And this weekend we heard from Trey Gowdy, who is on the Intelligence Committee, who had a large part in writing that memo. In what way does the president believe that the Republican memo vindicates him?
Look, the president has consistently called the Russia investigation politically motivated witch hunt for the last year, and the memo clearly vindicates the president's position that there was political bias in this process. It's pretty simple.
U.S. Secretary of Defense James Mattis and Air Force General Paul Selva, who is vice chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, testified on Capitol Hill Tuesday before the House Armed Services Committee. The two laid out the Pentagon's 2018 National Defense Strategy and Nuclear Posture Review. This was Secretary Mattis's opening statement to the committee.
I'm here at your invitation to testify on two subjects, the 2018 National Defense Strategy and the Nuclear Posture Review, and I'm joined by the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Selva. Even in the midst of our ongoing counterterrorism campaigns, my role is to keep the peace for one more year, one more month, one more day, giving Secretary Tillerson and our diplomats time to resolve crises through diplomatic channels. The Department of Defense does this by providing the Commander-in-Chief with military options that ensure our diplomats negotiate from a position of strength. Up front, I need to note 3 days from now, I will visit our nation's first Security Force Assistance Brigade in Fort Benning, Georgia, as they prepare to deploy to Afghanistan. To advance the security of our nation, these troops are putting themselves in harm's way, in effect signing a blank check payable to the American people with their lives. They do so despite Congress's abrogation of its constitutional responsibility to provide sufficient, stable funding. Our military has been operating under debilitating continuing resolutions for more than 1,000 days during the past decade. These men and women hold the line for America while lacking this most fundamental congressional support, a predictable budget. Congress mandated, rightfully mandated, this national defense strategy, the first one in a decade, and then shut down the government the day of its release. Today, we are again operating under a disruptive continuing resolution. It is not lost on me that as I testify before you this morning, we are again on the verge of a government shutdown, or at best, another damaging continuing resolution. I regret that without sustained, predictable appropriations, my presence here today wastes your time, because no strategy can survive, as you pointed out, Chairman, without the funding necessary to resource it. Yet we all know that America can afford survival. Nations as different as China and Russia have chosen to be strategic competitors. They seek to create a world consistent with their authoritarian models and pursue veto power over other nations' economic, diplomatic, and security decisions. Rogue regimes like North Korea and Iran persist in taking outlaw actions that undermine and threaten regional and global stability. And despite our successes to date against ISIS physical caliphate, violent extremist organizations continue to sow hatred, incite violence, and murder innocents. Across the globe, democracies are taking notice. We recognize great power competition is once again a reality. We will continue to prosecute the campaign against terrorism by, with, and through our allies. But in our new defense strategy, great power competition, not terrorism, is now the primary focus of U.S. national security. Our military remains capable, but our competitive edge has eroded in every domain of warfare: air, land, sea, cyber, and space. Under frequent continuing resolutions and sequestered budget caps, our advantages continue to shrink. The combination of rapidly changing technology, the negative impact on military readiness resulting from the longest continuous stretch of combat in our nation's history, and insufficient funding have created an overstretched and under-resourced military. During last week's State of the Union address, President Trump said weakness is the surest path to conflict. To those who might suggest that we should accept a year-long continuing resolution, it would mean a return to a disastrous sequestration level of funding for the military. And in a world awash in change and increasing threats, there is no room for complacency. History makes clear that no country has a preordained right to victory on the battlefield. Framed within President Trump's national security strategy and aligned with the Department of State, our 2018 National Defense Strategy provides clear strategic direction for America's military. A long-term strategic competition requires the seamless integration of multiple elements of national power: diplomacy, information, economics, finance, intelligence, law enforcement, and military. The Department's principal priorities are long-term strategic competitions with China and Russia. Given the magnitude of the threats they pose to U.S. security and prosperity today, Congress must commit to both an increased and sustained investment in our capabilities. Concurrently, the Department will sustain its efforts to deter and counter rogue regimes such as North Korea and Iran, defeat terrorist threats to the United States, and consolidate our gains in Iraq and Afghanistan while moving to a more resource-sustainable approach. More than any other nation, America can expand the competitive space. We can challenge our competitors where we possess advantages and they lack strength. To restore a competitive military edge, this defense strategy pursues three primary lines of effort: to build a more lethal force, to strengthen traditional alliances while building new partnerships, and reform the department's business practices for performance and affordability. Our first line of effort emphasizes that everything we do must contribute to the lethality of our military. In war, an enemy will attack a perceived weakness. Therefore, we cannot adopt a single preclusive form of warfare. Rather, we must be able to fight across the spectrum of combat. This means the size and composition of our force matters. The nation must field a sufficient, capable force to deter conflict. If deterrence fails, we must win. To defend our way of life, our military will embrace change while holding fast to traditional proven attributes that make us the most formidable force on any battlefield. Those who would threaten America's experiment in democracy must know, if you threaten us, it will be your longest and worst day. To implement this strategy, we will invest in key capabilities, recognizing we cannot expect success fighting tomorrow's conflicts with yesterday's weapons and equipment. Driven by this strategy, next week you will see in our FY19 budget investments the following: space and cyber, nuclear deterrent forces, missile defense, advanced autonomous systems, artificial intelligence, and professional military education to provide our high-quality troops what they need to win. We will prioritize rebuilding readiness while modernizing our existing force. We will also be changing our force's posture to prioritize readiness for warfighting and major combat, making us strategically predictable for our allies and operationally unpredictable for any adversary. Our second line of effort is to strengthen traditional alliances while building new partnerships. History is clear that nations with allies thrive. We inherited this approach to security and prosperity from the greatest generation, and it has served the United States well for 70 years. Working by, with, and through allies who carry their fair share is a source of strength. Since the costly victory in World War II, Americans have carried a disproportionate share of the global defense burden while others recovered. Today, the growing economic strength of allies and partners has enabled them to step up, as demonstrated by more than 70 nations and international organizations participating in the Defeat ISIS campaign, and again in the 40-some nations standing shoulder to shoulder in NATO's Resolute Support mission in Afghanistan. Most NATO allies are also increasing their defense budgets, giving credence to the value of democracies standing together. Our third line of effort serves as the foundation for our military's competitive edge. Reforming the business practices of the department to provide both solvency and security, and thereby gaining full benefit from every dollar spent. Every day, we will earn the trust of Congress and the American people. We must be good stewards of the tax dollars entrusted to us. In this regard, we will deliver our department's full financial audit this year, because results and accountability matter. The first audit in DOD's history will reveal how we can be better stewards. The department is transitioning to a culture of performance and affordability that operates at the speed of relevance. We will prioritize speed of delivery, continuous adaptation, and frequent modular upgrades. With your critical support, we will shed outdated management and acquisition processes while adopting American industry's best practices. If current structures inhibit our pursuit of lethality. I expect my service secretaries and defense agency heads to consolidate, eliminate, and restructure to achieve the mission. One of the key elements of the 2018 National Defense Strategy is to ensure America's military provides a safe, secure, and effective nuclear deterrent. Last January, President Trump directed a nuclear posture review to ensure the United States' nuclear deterrent is modern, robust, flexible, resilient, ready, and appropriately tailored to deter 21st century threats and reassure allies. I recently received a letter from senators concerned that the 2018 Nuclear Posture Review would undermine decades of U.S. leadership on efforts to reduce and eventually eliminate the existential threat posed by nuclear weapons. To the contrary, the 2018 Nuclear Posture Review reaffirms the mutually reinforcing role of nuclear deterrence in a complex and dynamic security environment, while underscoring continued U.S. commitment to nonproliferation, to counter nuclear terrorism, and to arms control. Specifically, the review reflects the Department of Defense's strategic priority to maintain a safe and effective nuclear deterrent that will successfully deter nuclear and non-nuclear strategic attacks, assure our allies and partners, respond effectively should deterrence fail, and hedge against future uncertainties and dangers. The United States remains committed to its global leadership role to reduce the number of nuclear weapons and to fulfill existing treaty and arms control obligations, leadership that has reduced our nuclear weapons stockpile by over 85% from its Cold War high. Yet we must recognize that deterrence and arms control can only be achieved with a credible capability. A review of the global nuclear situation is sobering. While Russia has reduced only the number of its accountable strategic nuclear force, as agreed upon in the New START Treaty, at the same time, Russia has been modernizing these weapons as well as other nuclear systems. Moscow advocates a theory of nuclear escalation for military conflict. China, too, is modernizing and expanding its already considerable nuclear forces, pursuing entirely new nuclear capabilities. It is also modernizing its conventional military to challenge U.S. military superiority. Despite universal condemnation in the United Nations, North Korea's nuclear provocations threaten regional and global peace, and Iran's nuclear ambitions remain an unresolved concern. Globally, nuclear terrorism remains a tangible threat. As Senator McCain said last week, since the end of the Cold War, we have let our nuclear capabilities atrophy under the false belief that the era of great power competition was over. As the new National Defense Strategy rightfully acknowledges, we now face the renewed threat of competition from Russia and China, and we cannot ignore their investments in nuclear weapons in addition to conventional forces. The 2018 Nuclear Posture Review reaffirms the findings of previous reviews that the nuclear triad, comprised of silo-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, bomber aircraft, and nuclear submarines, is the most strategically sound means of ensuring nuclear deterrence. To remain effective, however, we must recapitalize our Cold War legacy nuclear deterrent forces, continuing a modernization program initiated during the previous administration. To quote my predecessor, Secretary Carter, quote, "We have been in a nuclear arms race for two decades now, but the U.S. hasn't been running the race," unquote. And as you can see demonstrated in this chart over here in the corner of the room, that it that gives credence to my predecessor's observation, the nuclear delivery system development over the last 8 years shows numerous advances by Russia, by China, and by North Korea versus the near absence of such activity by the United States, with competitors and adversaries developing 34 new systems in that time as compared to only one for the U.S., the F-35 aircraft. Nuclear deterrence will continue to play a critical role in preventing nuclear attack and large-scale conventional warfare between nuclear-armed states for the foreseeable future. U.S. nuclear weapons assure and defend our allies against conventional and nuclear threats, furthering our non-proliferation goals and increasing global security. The National Defense Strategy and the Nuclear Posture Review align with the President's National Security Strategy, guiding all of our efforts. As I said earlier, no strategy can survive without the necessary stable, predictable funding. Failure to modernize our military risks leaving us with a force that could dominate the last war, but be irrelevant to tomorrow's security. We need Congress to lift the defense spending caps and support the budget for our military of $700 billion for this fiscal year and $716 billion for next fiscal year. Let me be clear, as hard as the last 16 years of war have been on our military, no enemy in the field has done as much to harm the readiness of the U.S. military than the combined impact of the Budget Control Act's defense spending caps, worsened by operating for 10 of the last 11 years under continuing resolutions of varied and unpredictable duration. The Budget Control Act was purposely designed to be so injurious that it would force Congress to pass necessary budgets. It was never intended to be the solution. For too long, we have asked our military to carry on stoically with a success at any cost attitude. Our troops work tirelessly to accomplish every mission with increasingly inadequate and misaligned resources simply because Congress has not maintained regular order. The fact that our volunteer military has performed so well is a credit to their dedication and professionalism. We expect the men and women of our military to be faithful in their service, even when going in harm's way. We must also remain faithful to them. Chairman, as you said in January, if Congress does not come together to find a way to fund this strategy, Secretary Mattis must explicitly inform Congress and the American people of the consequences of failure. The consequences of not providing a budget are clear. Even though we are protecting ongoing operations from continuing resolution disruptions, each increment of funding in support of our partners in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria requires a 15-day congressional notification. My commanders in the field write to me for help in getting timely and predictable funds for their efforts as they work to execute our strategy against the enemy in the field. Additionally, should we stumble into a year-long continuing resolution, your military will not be able to provide pay for our troops by the end of the fiscal year. We will not recruit the 15,000 Army soldiers and 4,000 Air Force airmen required to fill critical manning shortfalls. We will not maintain our ships at sea with the proper balance between operations and time in port for maintenance. We will ground aircraft due to a lack of maintenance and spare parts. We will deplete the ammunition, training, and manpower required to deter war and delay contracts for vital acquisition programs necessary to modernize the force. Further, I cannot overstate the impact to our troops' morale from all this uncertainty. Today, as I sit here, we are engaged in prudent planning in the Pentagon for another disruptive government shutdown. You know that I cannot care more about our country's defense than this Congress, for it is Congress alone which has the constitutional authority to raise and support armies and to provide and maintain a Navy. We need Congress back in the driver's seat, not in the spectator's seat of the Budget Control Act's indiscriminate and automatic cuts. I know that in time of a major war, Congress will provide our military with all it needs. But money at the time of crisis fails to deter war. And you know we would be at that point to have nothing, no time to prepare, as it takes months and years to produce the munitions, the training, and readiness required to fight well. To carry out the strategy you rightly directed we develop, we need you to pass a budget now. If we are to sustain our military's primacy, we need budget predictability. Congress must take action now to ensure our military's lethality is sufficient to defend our way of life, to preserve the promise of prosperity, and to pass on the freedoms we enjoy to the next generation. And I ask that you not let disagreements on domestic policy continue to hold our nation's defense hostage. General Selva will now discuss the military dimensions of the 2018 National Defense Strategy and our nuclear posture review. Thank you.
General Selva.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ranking Member Smith and distinguished members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to join Secretary Mattis to brief on the National Defense Strategy and the Nuclear Posture Review. General Dunford and I, along with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, fully support the strategies outlined in the National Defense Strategy and in the Nuclear Posture Review. Both documents are the product of significant consultation and collaboration between members of the Joint Staff and the OSD staff. The National Defense Strategy provides detailed defense policy guidance for military strategy, planning, and operations. Therefore, the Chairman's 2016 Classified National Military Strategy will require an update to maintain complete consistency with the National Defense Strategy and the President's National Security Strategy released in December. Immediately upon release of the National Defense Strategy published last month, General Dunford directed the Joint Staff to commence a revision of the National Military Strategy, and that process is now underway. Other subsequent guidance and plans will be revised in turn to support the lines of effort outlined in the National Defense Strategy and to operationalize the concept of dynamic force employment. Additionally, we have begun to review the Joint Staff's organization and processes to determine if we need to make adjustments to support the Chairman's global integrator responsibilities and to better position the Chairman to support the Secretary's decision-making processes. Refining the National Military Strategy and the Joint Staff's organization and processes are a step towards increasing the lethality and flexibility of the joint force in light of the reemergence of great power competitions. The Nuclear Posture Review also reflects the realities of today's security environment, as well as projecting the future environment and its potential impacts on U.S. nuclear weapons policy and strategy. More specifically, the Nuclear Posture Review paid particular attention to Russian, Chinese, and North Korean activities intended to develop, modernize, and expand their nuclear weapons capabilities and to integrate them into their military strategies and doctrine. The Nuclear Posture Review takes into account the potential for Iran to renew its pursuit of nuclear weapons and capability in the future. The review has determined that our strategy must be tailored to each of these potential adversaries to effectively communicate the costs of aggression, and this tailored strategy approach requires that the United States maintain a flexible and credible mix of nuclear and conventional capabilities that can address a spectrum of adversaries and threats over a significant period of time. It should not be lost on this committee that the Nuclear Posture Review conducted its assessment across a 30-year swath of the future. The Nuclear Posture Review reaffirms the nation's nuclear triad as the bedrock of our ability to deter aggression, assure our allies, and hedge against an uncertain future. And as the Secretary has mentioned, it reaffirms the need to recapitalize each component of our legacy nuclear systems to ensure that our nuclear capabilities remain ready, secure, capable, and credible now and into the future. Two supplemental capabilities recommended in the Nuclear Posture Review, the nuclear-armed sea-launched cruise missile and a modification of a small number of existing submarine-launched ballistic missile warheads, would enhance deterrence by ensuring that no adversary, under any set of circumstances, can perceive an advantage through the use of a limited nuclear escalation or other strategic attack. Fielding these capabilities will not lower the threshold at which the U.S. would employ nuclear weapons. Rather, it will raise the nuclear threshold for potential adversaries, making the use of nuclear weapons less likely. Nuclear weapons pose the only existential military threat to our nation. Therefore, there is no higher priority for the joint force than fielding all of the components of an effective nuclear deterrent to deter potential adversaries from nuclear attack on any scale. It is important to note that the National Defense Strategy and the Nuclear Posture Review both make the assumption that the military will receive timely, predictable, and sufficient funding to execute these strategies. As General Mattis has emphasized, we in uniform appreciate the support of this committee and the Congress, and we trust that the Congress will provide the funding needed to turn these strategies into reality.
Meanwhile, a new Pentagon public relations campaign, which targets American taxpayers with their own money, was announced by the State Department Tuesday. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert described the program at her daily press conference Tuesday.
The DOD's campaign called This Is Your Military. It's a new DOD initiative aimed at connecting the American public with the military by showing them a unique view into the lives of those who are currently serving our country. We will highlight the hard work of the 7,000 veterans who currently are employed by the Department of State. The initiative will focus on our Marine security guards who protect our embassies worldwide, the National Guard and the reservists, and the approximately 7,000 veterans that the State Department employs around the world. DOD will produce videos to be released as part of an initiative that showcases the National Guard, reservists, veteran success stories who work with the Department of State.
Nauert then introduced Amber Smith, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Outreach, to provide additional details.
Today, fewer Americans have a direct connection to those who serve in the military. Research shows that the civ-military divide is continuing to expand, which threatens the viability and the sustainability of the all-volunteer force, which poses some long-term national security risks. This Is Your Military is a Department of Defense outreach initiative that will educate and inform the American public while introducing them, the less than 1% of Americans who are currently serving in the military, to the 99% who are not. We also want to show how the military is relevant to Americans in their daily lives and for future generations, as well as how we are a force for good. We look forward to collaborating with the Department of State by highlighting the Marine security guards that protect our embassies worldwide, the National Guard, the reservists, and the nearly 7,000 veterans that the department employs around the world who are all a part of the This Is Your Military story. The initiative will showcase the real lives of those who are serving in the military and correct common misperceptions that exist today. We will encourage Americans to learn about the military's missions, our capabilities, who is serving, and why they serve. Each month, we'll focus on specific themes. We will release 10 to 15 videos per month on social media that give a behind-the-scenes look into military life. We will have increased coverage of live events as they relate to the military, and we'll collaborate with our external partners to reach an audience that is not normally connected to the military.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Two Americas, two intensely charged and opposing news narratives. Do cable news networks reflect these divisions, or rather function as triggers intensifying cultural divide? Also, what has happened to journalism? Is it now a profession inhabited by hacks and the politically possessed? Crosstalking America Divided, I'm joined by my guest, Rob Taub in New York. He's a political pundit and journalist contributing to the Huffington Post. Also in New York, we have Julio Rivera. He is the editorial director of Reactionary Times and a Newsmax columnist. And in Los Angeles, we have Ron Placone. He is a comedian, a frequent guest on The Jimmy Dore Show and The Young Turks, as well as host of his own streaming show, Get Your News On with Ron. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Ron, you got up earliest for this program, so you are elected to answer the first question here. A great deal of my time, I watch cable news. I try to watch as much of all of them to get a variety of them. And, you know, it's obvious to say that we live in two very, very different Americas, the two Americas that don't know each other at all anymore. So when I look at the cable news networks, I mean, do they reflect this cultural divide, or are they really intensifying it? I mean, do they magnify it? Because you certainly would get that feeling looking at MSNBC and Fox. Go ahead.
I think that they definitely intensify a divide, yes. Do they reflect what's really going on in the states or amidst the people that live here? I would say absolutely not. And to the point where I try very hard to no longer even use the phrase mainstream media.
Yeah, okay.
I try to refer to it to what it is. I call it the corporate media because that's what it is. It's owned by a small elite group of corporations. They have an agenda. They have a narrative. They have certain things that they're not allowed to talk about. But as far as the division goes, I mean, yeah, and you brought up the memo as a for instance, and I think that's a very good example. You know, on one side, you had at MSNBC trying to make it out like, oh, this is absolutely nothing. Then on the other side, you know, on Fox News, for instance, you had, oh, this is absolutely everything. And the truth is that, you know, there are things to learn in every given rhetorical event. So, yeah, there's certainly an agenda, but really it's just most of the time political theater between the most elite among us and isn't really reflecting what's going on in the United States. And more people are disenfranchised
with
the media.
That's why people come to us and other alternative media. Jimmy Dore you're on very often, and I really much enjoy his
program. Yeah, that's why I have a job. Yeah.
And he's a progressive. I consider myself a conservative, but I find him a reasonable person. I find you a reasonable person to talk to. And Rob, more or less the same question to you, because it seems to me if you look at MSNBC and then you look at Fox, basically what both are doing is they're reacting to a status quo that is changing. And I think that rattles both of them, okay? Because we're still reeling from the election of Donald Trump. And the media is trying to, or not trying to, adjust to that political reality. So it seems to me that, you know, before the media horizon, there was the terrain was there. People understood it. But it's changed very radically since then. And I think that sees the extreme and the networks that I've just mentioned. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, when Ron was talking about corporations, I mean, what are we doing? We're going for ratings because they're going to make more money. And I used to be a 3-times-a-week guest on Fox representing, I would say, what I called myself as a sane liberal as opposed to a knee-jerk liberal or a complete jerk liberal. Those are my different types of liberals. But I'm going to harken back to a book written in 1973 that's always been one of my favorites, and it's really proved prescient. News from Nowhere by Edward J. Epstein. And he was talking about how television news was terrible because they don't actually provide you real news.
Yep.
They're getting fed information from big corporations and from PR departments. And so what I find offensive is I actually got into a little shoving, not a shoving match, but a little verbal jousting years ago with Matt Lauer because he gave me this I'm a journalist kind of thing at a function. And he's a journalist like I'm Tom Brady. And we've forgotten what real journalism is. And we don't have shoe leather on the sidewalk journalism anymore, but we may not be able to have that because who's going to pay for it? So where do we, in effect, get real news from except sources and leaks?
That's a good point. Julio, you know, and it seems to me that it has got down to just hacks because, as I said in the introduction of the program, is that you know, I'll be very open with. I'm very sympathetic to Tucker Carlson, for example. I think he's a pretty reasonable person, and he has opposing people on all the time on his program. But if you look at like Hannity and you look at Rachel Maddow, I mean, they never let anything that disturbs their world in, you know, enter it. And I find that really disturbing because that's just basically giving red meat to your viewers. You're not teaching them anything. You're just reaffirming. It's an affirmation process in watching the two that I just mentioned here. And I don't think that they use a whole lot of news. It's an enormous amount of spin. Go ahead, Julio.
Well, no, not necessarily.
Okay.
I mean, this is the one thing I would say. And to speak to, you know, Rachel Maddow and her colleague over at MSNBC, Mika Brzezinski, saying, and she was quoted as saying, we have to control what people think. I mean, I think it needs to be fact-based. I think there is an extreme lack of integrity in reporting at this point.
I agree.
But the truth of the matter is that outlets like Fox and Newsmax are actually reporting facts, things that have gone on. And if you look at Donald Trump, when he was on his Asian tour, he struck an energy deal that closed our trade deficit with China by about $80 billion. If you looked at the news that day, The news was the speculation that this Russia probe supposedly was going to shift to Trump directly. And now we're looking at this in February, still hasn't yielded anything substantial that they can pin to Trump. So it's always been about trying to make the Trump administration look bad from the left. And there is a little bit of a defense mechanism going on in right-leaning media, but it's usually a lot more fact-based coming from the right.
Yeah, well, I would agree. I mean, the memo, for example, I mean, when you look at CNN and MSNBC, they're just in denial, okay? I mean, you know, 1 hour they say it's a danger to national security, and then when it's released, they say it's nothing here, move along, nothing to see. I mean, they're in denial here. Let me go to Ron in Los Angeles. I mean, in that sense, I would agree with Julio. I mean, they don't even want to address the content of the memo, for example. I read it. It's very interesting. It's something I think is very, very important. But you have the liberal corporatist media, I will take your term. They just dismiss it out of hand because, again, it endangers what they believe is the status quo. And they have the right and the privilege to tell the world how to think or tell the American public how to think. Go ahead, Ron.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm a very progressive guy, and I used to really love Rachel Maddow. I used to consider her a diamond in the rough. But recently, you know, I mean, I say if you watch Rachel Maddow's show and you take a shot of vodka every time she says the word Russia,
you're gonna be
I think the average person would probably be dead within 20 minutes. The media has a very... The media has a very corporate agenda.
I'm going to try that tonight.
You know, they very much...
Rob, don't do it.
I'm not responsible.
Don't do it. No, you need... And crosstalk will not be held responsible.
I got to protect myself here. I don't recommend anyone doing that.
Okay, we'll put...
I don't recommend anyone actually doing that.
We'll put a disclaimer on at the end of the program. Okay. Finish up, Ron. Go ahead.
Thank you. But, yeah, I mean, they have their corporate, you know, I'll give another, for instance, you know, MSNBC is owned by Comcast. You've not seen an honest report on net neutrality from MSNBC. You haven't really seen it in any of the corporate media, but especially not from them, because they're owned by Comcast, a very anti-net neutrality company. You know, when DAPL was going on, all of the corporate media, Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, they're all funded in large part by oil and gas companies. So, of course, they're not going to tell you what's going on in terms of a water protest. Where do you hear about that? You hear about that from the journalists that are on the ground.
You know,
Ron, on that point,
I do remember watching across the board and almost one of those rare moments of unity. Everybody said it's important, period. We didn't get anything more than that, okay? I learned more about net neutrality listening to the Jimmy Dore show. It was an excellent program on net neutrality. I learned an enormous amount there.
Thank you.
Okay. You know, Rob, let me go back to you. One of the things that I find really disturbing in our political discourse is that if you oppose someone, they're a traitor. They act in a treasonous way. And I criticize Donald Trump for that, and I certainly criticize MSNBC and CNN for peddling the same thing. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, one of the things that really used to infuriate me when I was a regular contributor to Fox, I've always been a Democrat, is I had people that would suddenly contact me on Facebook or via Twitter or an email and say, I can't believe you're a traitor and you're on Fox. And then I would respond and say, well, did you see me when I was on this week? No, I won't watch it. Well, then how do you know what I'm saying or what I'm contributing? And really, as a result of Fox, I've met a lot of interesting conservative people that I never would have met who follow me on Twitter or I've spoken to on Sirius Radio, and I really enjoy the interaction between us. One of the things I think that we have to make the distinction about also is that there are news shows and there are opinion shows.
Sure.
The problem is that the opinion shows have taken over, and the news shows, many of them, are letting too many opinions creep in, and it can be with a raised eyebrow or an inflection, and that's wrong if you're supposed to be a reporter and you're giving the news and you're supposed to let the viewer or the reader decide.
Rob, let me jump in here before we go to the break.
I take issue with that.
You know, before we go to the break, but I tend to think, particularly with this Russiagate thing, and it was the liberal corporate stations, facts get in the way of spin for them, and I think that's why you get so few facts. I mean, the memo, the contents substance of the memo wasn't really discussed, but it was about the timing of it. Well, no, we have the memo. We can read it. We can talk about it. No, okay, but we'll have to wait for the Democratic one. I mean, this is what irritates me. Gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the media and their divide in America. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Julio, let me go to you in New York here. I asked Rob about using the word traitor and being considered treacherous or treasonous here. It's very difficult to have a conversation with someone after you've called them that, okay? And this is what I find very dangerous. I mean, I can give you a real-life example. I'm, you know, from the great saga called Russia, 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 okay? And all of the name-calling of leaders around the world, and then how do you sit down and talk? Okay? And I think that this is what's really foolish about journalism. I mean, you get that hyperventilation that, you know, you get the adrenaline rush and you feel really great. But then when you, you know, think about what you just said, and you're supposed to be some kind of play some kind of public roles, you know, adding value to the public sphere. And then you call he's a traitor, you're a traitor. You know, it doesn't get down to it's not disagreeing with someone now. It is you're morally unacceptable. That's not what we should do in journalism. Go ahead, Julio.
Well, I think that the problem is the word moderate has become a dirty word. I think that the left has gone far to the left. I think the right has gone far to the right, even to the point where you have Republican, a ton of Republican infighting. I mean, we've got phrases like rhino, sellout Republicans, anytime, you know, they want to make a deal with the Democrats. So that's kind of the world that we're operating in right now. But unfortunately, it's being fueled, I think, more or less because the larger and the larger percentage of mainstream media sources, although that's kind of a dirty word that we don't always like to use, are so skewed against the president. You know, they've been trying to undermine President Trump this entire time. So that's why their reporting right now isn't really necessarily reporting. It's 100% spin. It's almost like their news programs have become opinion programs. Yeah. And there isn't really a lot of, you know, let's say moderate or middle of the road news that exists anymore in America.
You know, Ron, I saw Trey Gowdy on Face the Nation. The country needs more people like that. You may disagree with his politics, but at least he listened to hard questions and he acknowledged some give and take, which I was so refreshing to see. It was a really remarkable moment. But, you know, what I get if we compare, let's say, Hannity and Rachel Maddow, you know, both of them have one thing in common, one phrase. Our democracy is at stake. Our democracy is being threatened, but for very, very different ways. Again, maybe I'm off on this here, but it's the status quo, the new status quo that's coming into being that they don't seem to understand here. We have a FBI that has gone rogue. It's been gotten rogue for a long time. It's nothing new. It's just the curtain has revealed this. This has been going on a long time. Does anybody remember J. Edgar Hoover? I mean, I do. Okay. That's a child, at least. OK, so, I mean, you know, using this, you know, our democracy is under threat. I find that really hard to believe in, and I find it very disingenuous. Go ahead, Ron.
I'm 100% with you. And in fact, whenever somebody says to me, hey, Trump hijacked our democracy, you know, I don't like Trump. But my response is, well, we were kind of overdue to look into a new one anyway. So maybe that's a blessing in disguise. Yeah. And you hit the nail on the head with the status quo comment, Peter. What nobody really wants to talk about in the corporate media is that the status quo is broken. And yep. Julio, I would say to you, you know, I think on a lot of issues, we probably don't see eye to eye. But I think that the reason that moderate has become a quote unquote dirty word isn't necessarily because being moderate is right or wrong, but because the status quo is so completely broken. And people are disenfranchised as a response to that. You know, Donald Trump ran on this idea of some kind of outsider, some kind of, you know, guy that was really going to disrupt the status quo. You know, and whether folks bought that or not, you know, I personally didn't. I don't think that's what he is at all. But that's what he ran on and that's what he sold. And people bought into that because they're so tired of the status quo and neoliberalism.
Okay, well, Rob, I...
He has done it on some levels, though.
Continue. Go ahead. Julio?
No, obviously he has done it on some levels.
Are you going to Ron or to Rob?
We've seen as far.
Keep going, Julio. Yeah. Go ahead. In New York, go ahead.
Oh, no, okay. I'm sorry. I apologize. It's the delay. I'm sorry. No, but he has done that on some levels. And I think that that's the reason that why there's been so much opposition to him, you know, because we're going to finally, I think, and they're going to do this to themselves. I think the elements that were anti-Trump are going to lead to, you know, uncovering a lot of the things that went on during the Obama administration, you know, things that were conducted by Hillary Clinton, things that were conducted by Barack Obama, the Justice Department, Loretta Lynch, Eric Holder. All this information is going to come out as a result of their crybabying and being anti-Trump, because he was ultimately seen as a threat because he's not really necessarily in bed with a lot of these people that were the status quo for a long period
of time. You bring up a really interesting point, and let me go to Rob right now, because it's something that I've been mulling over quite a bit, and again, it's this memo issue here, is that, you know, it seems to me, and I read the memo very carefully, and I find it very believable, okay? I've been, unfortunately, I have to follow this story 24-7. It's forced on you, and it's a fictitious story. But what isn't fictitious is malfeasance at the highest level of the DOJ and the FBI. I mean, I am convinced of that, and I thought the memo was laid out a very interesting narrative. But, Rob, the problem is the mainstream media just denies it. And I find that, and this is what part of this cultural civil war that is brewing in the United States, is that you do have a part of the population, of the public, that is aware of these, what I think are reasonable facts to believe. And then you have the corporatists here in the media denying it. And I think that that can't be elevated in the air for very long, because people are going to say, well, I mean, Flynn is going to go to jail, Manafort's going to go to jail, but, you know, Comey lied. Clinton lied to the FBI, and they're not going to go to jail. And at that point, there's going to be a train wreck. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, first of all, I think we're getting into way too much supposition, which is a big problem right now in the media. Media shouldn't be acting on either side, be it right or left or whomever,
absolutely,
as a judge, jury, and executioner.
Absolutely.
And comparative, okay. And just as an aside, I'm sorry, but I've been chuckling about this. When J. Edgar Hoover got mentioned, I thought, what kind of nickname would Trump come up with him? Cross-dressing J. Edgar? But anyway, I'm going to get a little tangential here, Peter.
Okay.
Peter, Ron, and Julio. But one of the things that really bugs me, and I feel that people who do what we do, at least at the highest echelons, and I'm talking about the highest paid people, like a Maddow or Sean Hannity, if I were king, I would force them to get on the Third Avenue bus with me, where it originates way down in the Bowery, and ride it all the way up to 125th Street a couple of times a week. Because I like to do that. I get stories there. I meet people there. And I interact with the actual public that I then speak to on radio, television, or via a column. And I think that if you're going to call yourself a journalist and you don't do that, and instead you ride around in a limousine and make your $30 million a year, or whatever it's going to be, I don't understand how you feel that you can aptly communicate with the public. So I think we have a big problem there.
I agree.
It's kind of like being a professional athlete now. I mean, are you really in touch with your fan base?
Yeah, I mean, Ron, being a journalist in television is just another word for being a high-paid celebrity, okay? I suppose, you know, they're going to have their own, celebrity awards where everybody shows up, okay? But, you know, Ron, this is one of the things that I find worrisome, is that you have a corporate media that has no interest in the public whatsoever. They have a bottom line. They have their donors. They have their sponsors and all that. I mean, for them, that system is perfected here. But they get further and further away, because I'm convinced that it was the corporatist media that elected Donald Trump by calling the rest of us deplorables, okay, and running with that and smearing at us and laughing at us and talking down to us, okay? And I think that I'm from the Midwest. People don't like to be talked that way from both coasts, okay? It's going to happen again in 2020 if they don't change their tune. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, you know, I don't disagree with that. I mean, I do think that the corporatist media did elect Donald Trump. And this is, just the whole model. You know, I say that if you want a democratic experiment to be successful and you have the media structure that we have in the United States, That would be a lot like wanting to open a gourmet restaurant and cooking exclusively with Spam and no other ingredient. I mean, yep. it's just not the right kind of structure to have the society we want. The one silver lining in all that, though, is that, I mean, people are leaving cable television yep. news in droves. I mean, the confidence in cable news gets lower and lower every year. There's academic studies that come out constantly. There was a Harvard study recently that revealed that what the media talks about and what people actually care about is so disproportional. It's about 75% to 6%.
Yeah.
And that's why people like me have a job. That's why there's shows on YouTube that are sustainable now.
Yes.
Because people are so thirsty for actual news, and they're finding it.
I'll give you Mark Dice. I mean, his daily video. I mean, he's competing with the major networks. This one guy. Okay? I mean, Jimmy Dore does very well. And anytime Jordan Peterson is on anyone's program, the hits go through the ceiling here. I'm agreeing with Ron. Let me go to Rob because I think, you know, people are so desperate to hear different voices and stop having spin pounded down your throat all the time. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, the last time I was on the show, what we discussed is one of my favorite lines from the classic film Broadcast News is Albert Brooks says, you know, we're in trouble when we become more important than the story. Yeah. And there is way too much spin. And we're also it becomes so much about ratings. And I started in scripted television on comedy shows. And, you know, I learned early, you know, well, it doesn't matter if you're funny or if it's good. What are the ratings and what do the Nielsen say? And so you're striving for that rather than ultimately delivering the news or the real story. And again, from both sides, I have certain sources I've used, and boy, have they been wrong. But in the first week of December, I sat down and had an interview with an attorney who's really plugged in, and he was telling me, in two weeks, Kushner is going to be indicted. Well, you know,
okay.
I mean,
all right.
Of the things.
Hang
I
on
get
here,
from
Rob. I got to jump in here,
wrong.
Guys. We've run out of time. I certainly miss Walter Cronkite. Many thanks to my guests in New York and in Los Angeles, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.